I'm a helper. I'm wired to help people. I'm sure the way I was raised has something to do with that. My parents were caring, generous, hospitable people, always looking out for neighbors who were in a hard spot. And they were raised by missionary-minded parents who were constantly out and about among those in need, whether in the jungles of India, as Esther Augsburger shared last week with the children about my missionary grandparents and my dad, her brother, or on my mom's side, whose family lived in a mission church in Columbia, Pennsylvania. Columbia was once a thriving industrial center, but when my mom was growing up, it was a poverty-stricken town that had never recovered from the Great Depression. She and her siblings and parents would walk the streets learning to know the poorest of their neighbors, trying to help them find a fuller life, both spiritually and physically. Helping people is what I know how to do. It's how I was taught. It's the environment in which I was formed. And thank God for that formation. Without it, I wouldn't be a pastor today. Without it, I wouldn't have done what I did before I was a pastor. For those who don't know this about me, I was a social worker before being a pastor. Straight out of college, I took a job as a case manager for Older Americans Council in Gainesville, Florida, a nonprofit agency that served senior citizens living at home, giving them the resources they needed to stay at home as long as possible. Meals on Wheels, home health aides, emergency alert systems, and housekeepers and the like. I was paid to be a professional helper. The agency gave me a desk, a phone, office supplies, reimbursed mileage when I drove into remote rural areas. I even requested funds once to establish a branch office in a small rural town so I could be more accessible to those I was helping. I became a very efficient helper. Now, relative to other professions I could have been in, working at a state-funded nonprofit was bare bones. My salary was low, resources were relatively few, but relative to the people I was helping, I had power and resources to spare. Still, we had to set limits. The one being helped had to be poor enough, had to be impaired enough. So I, a low-paid 24-year-old guy in jeans and driving a beat-up car, had the status, the education, the resources, and the power of the state behind me to give and withhold help at my discretion. And those getting the help just had to suck it up and allow the necessary indignities of having a guy with a clipboard sit at the foot of their bed and ask them how much they made each month in Social Security and how much money they had in their bank and whether they could go to the bathroom by themselves. Now, did I do a lot of good for a lot of people through the social services I put into motion? Absolutely. Because of what I did, some people lived longer and happier and safer in their own homes. I'm glad about that. But I could never quite get over the nagging feeling that my helping reinforced my position of power and reinforced their position of powerlessness. There is a shadow side to being a helper. This is true for well-meaning 24-year-olds with a clipboard, and it's true for groups and institutions like the church. Any of you directly involved in any of our mission and outreach efforts here at Parkview have come, I think, face to face with this nagging awareness that helping others is complicated. When we open our doors to shelter and feed our homeless neighbors, when we send funds to our mission agencies, when we support the development and relief work of Mennonite Central Committee or Mennonite Disaster Service, when we support the Sharing Fund of Mennonite World Conference, when we give funds or send people to help out our sister church in New Orleans' Ninth Ward, when we support local groups like People Helping People, New Bridges Immigrant Resource Center, Our Community Place, many others, we are certainly answering God's call to love our neighbor. And that we must do and must continue doing. We cannot turn our back on our neighbors who are poor or marginalized or are fearing deportation. But let's be honest with ourselves. Helping others puts into motion new relationship dynamics that we need to recognize and deal with somehow. How do we, who enjoy a position of higher status and greater privilege and more resources, help without creating dependence or disempowering those we help? How do we keep from being overprotective of our own power and resources? How do we keep from slipping into a controlling posture that will only extend help if the helpee fully cooperates with us, plays by our rules, submits to our authority, meets our expectations? Help, when given from the top down, is always, in one way or another, exchanged for something else. That if not actual material or money to be repaid later, then it's some intangible benefit that we get in return now. Maybe it's public recognition. Maybe it's psychological or spiritual benefit that we get. Maybe it's an unspoken or even unrecognized expectation that helping the less fortunate will ensure that our respective roles, the helper and helpee, won't ever get flipped upside down. Helping from a position of power can reinforce our position of power, whether that's intentional or not. But everything I've just described is confronted head on by the gospel story we just heard. Despite all the good that I believe I have done in my life as a helper, as a social worker, as a pastor, as father, husband, neighbor, friend, I think I would do well, and I think we would all do well, to examine all of that in the light of Jesus. To look at Jesus as a model for how to be with people, especially with people in need, whatever that need may be. Jesus, as we know, was a consummate helper. Everywhere he went, he helped, healed, fed, restored, forgave, delivered, taught. But in today's gospel, we see another side of Jesus. Here it was Jesus who needed help. We don't often think of Jesus in terms of his very real and very physical and very human needs. But he had them. And they were sometimes desperate needs. In this story, I imagine that Jesus' needs border on desperation. Just a little background. In the eyes of Jews, the Samaritans were ceremonially unclean, that is, unfit to worship at the temple. Presumably, then, a close encounter with a Samaritan would make a Jew unclean and require a purification ritual. So devout Jews took the long route around the region of Samaria. It was just simpler. Longer travel time now, less religious time and hassle later. For whatever reason, Jesus and his disciples went through Samaria. Maybe their travel schedule required it. Maybe they were running low in supplies, but they calculated, I suppose, that it would be better to take the short route and pay for it later. As soon as they arrived in the town of Samaria, the disciples went into the city to buy food and supplies. Jesus stayed by the well. Why? Contrary to popular belief, Jesus didn't stay because he knew he had spiritual business to do with a Samaritan woman who would stop by soon. We know that was not the reason, because John 4:6 tells us exactly why he sat down by the well. He was exhausted, tired out by his journey, John says. Traveling on foot was grueling. I expect Jesus was wobbly on his feet by that time. As a rabbi, I doubt he had the stamina of some of his fishermen disciples. He says, "You go get the food. I've got to rest." So there he sat at the well at noon in the heat of the day, alone, hot, thirsty, without a bucket. I'm guessing he was eyeing everyone who came along thinking, anybody have a bucket? Anybody? The odds of someone coming to the well at noon was pretty slim. So when the Samaritan woman came along carrying a bucket, don't tell me that Jesus' first thoughts were, oh, here's a chance to teach a valuable spiritual lesson. No, his only thought was getting water from that bucket. It was pure need that made him ask, "Will you give me a drink?" Simple, straightforward question, "Will you give me a drink?" Except it wasn't that simple. There were other layers here. She was a Samaritan. She was a woman. Both those facts put Jesus in the power position. This was not a conversation between equals. To make the story even more interesting, we find out that she was not your average, respectable Samaritan woman. Her marital history and sexual behavior put her on the margins of her own people. She came to the well alone at noon herself, instead of morning or evening when other women would be there socializing and drink and drawing water together. But Jesus puts all these significant power dynamics aside and expresses his own need to this woman, to this marginalized Samaritan woman. Jesus let his human vulnerability show. He made no pretense. He needed her. He asked her to be so kind as to reach out to him and meet his need. His act of vulnerability was so remarkable that it stunned the Samaritan woman, and it rendered Jesus' disciples speechless. John 4:27 tells us literally that the things they didn't say when they came back. And then, yes, there was a significant secondary interaction that arose between the woman and Jesus that quickly got into other spiritual and theological issues that would be interesting to explore today about the nature of worship, about eternal life, about the metaphor of living water. That's part of what was said at that time, but I expect that some of that was even filled in later in the telling as John, the gospel writer, distills what no doubt was an extended theological discourse between Jesus and the Samaritans, because we know Jesus spent two more days there in that town interacting with the townspeople. But that aside, the, the most remarkable thing that confronts the reader of this story upon reading it is that here sits Jesus opening himself up to and allowing himself to receive ministry from a socially suspect Samaritan woman. And here we also sit today, people of power in need of help, but not wanting to be very vulnerable so as to protect our standing. We have the resources to help others, and generally we do, happily and generously and even self-sacrificially. But when the need is ours, we hesitate. We don't want to risk too much. We need to guard our position. Letting go of the need to protect our position opens up all kinds of interesting possibilities. In the story of Jesus and the woman, when Jesus ignored his position and became vulnerable, he not only got his need met, he was able to help his helper in a deeper way and in turn help the whole town. I can't help but think that this same dynamic, the impulse to protect our standing and not become too vulnerable, plays into so much of the divisiveness, the conflict, the anxiety that plagues our church, our community, our national politics. The helping dynamic is different in those things and in our personal needs. But nevertheless, we may be trying to help our neighbor to, say, get on the right side of the issue, my side, and thereby help solve the conflict. But whatever the need is that we are trying to help today, chances are there is an impulse at work in us that doesn't come from Jesus. It's the impulse to put up our guards, to hide our weakness, to maintain our position of power over the other. Sisters and brothers in Christ, we sit here this morning thirsty. Our strength is dried up from our journey. Some of us are wobbly on our feet. Our weariness may come from the deep hurt of the larger world in which we live. Our weariness may come from the wounds that we experience much closer to us, from strained or broken family relationships, from loss and grief, from prolonged conflict, from insecurity about our future, from being betrayed by persons or institutions that once we had trust in, from internal spiritual struggle playing itself out in our lives in ways we don't fully understand. But I know from personal experience and from conversations that many of us here today thirst desperately and have no bucket, have no way to fix things on our own, no way to quench our thirst ourselves or satisfy our own longings. We need help. And we're even more vulnerable when alone at high noon and no bucket-toting person in sight. Let's sit with that thought a bit. Consider the source of your own weariness and thirst. What is it drying up your strength today, making your knees weak, I invite you to come and sit by the well. Our Lenten ritual this morning is coming for water, as you might expect, and this water you see is right here at the table, our well. But there are no drinking vessels at the well. You will need to come to this well and wait for someone else to come and help you draw water. If you are led this morning for whatever is going on in your life to seek water, just come and stand near this front table and wait as long as it takes. Someone else, I trust, will see you standing there and will be moved to come and be that Samaritan woman. We'll go to one of these two small tables on either side and take a small cup and come to where you are and pour you a drink of water. You don't even have to know the person waiting here at the well. Jesus and the woman were strangers. Anyone can help draw the water, even youth, children. You can come and take a cup and help out. You're capable. Remember the relative position of the helper and helpee in age, gender, status. Does not matter when you're thirsty. All are welcome to come as those who thirst or as those with a bucket. Come while the rest of us sing again. Bring me a little water, Sylvie. No matter what the source of your thirst, come to the well and wait. And no matter your connection to the one who thirsts, come and help them get water. Or do both. In the story, Jesus and the woman were both the helper and the helpee in different ways. So here we are together at the community well. Come and be refreshed by the water of God's Spirit, carried by God's people.